The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, well, let's get started. My name is Tim Griffith. I teach at New St. Andrews College. I've taught there for about 11 years, teach Latin. Sometimes they let me teach Greek, but not very often. Before that, I taught at Logos School and taught in the middle school and the high school. Before that, I taught at a little school called Atlas, that where I taught third grade and up. And I've also taught my own children Latin from the time they were very, very little. So I've had the opportunity to teach Latin to people of all ages. I've even taught some graduate classes where I've had Latin students that were as old as in their 60s. And so I feel like I've had an opportunity to teach people of all different ages. And the topic I want to talk about today, teaching meaning, I think really applies no matter what age you're teaching. So I know some of you all teach the elementary, some high school, but this really applies no matter what your audience is. Before I get into this, I want to make clear one of my presuppositions. So I'm presuming that the point of teaching Latin, or our goal, our immediate goal, is to teach people to read Latin. And I'm saying this because this is what Sayers was saying, and this is as well as C.S. Lewis and those who really got the ACCS started. The whole point was to teach students to read Latin. Now, of course, they wanted students to read Latin because of some other benefits, okay? But as far as teachers are concerned, I think our goal actually needs to be teaching our kids to read Latin, because that is a goal that is measurable, okay? At the end of the day, you can know whether or not your students can read something, whereas it's very difficult to know whether or not they've been culturally enriched, okay? Although that's one of that's why we're teaching Latin in the first place. It's not something that is easy to measure and see how you're doing, okay? So I'm just assuming that. For anyone who has taught in the high school, where you really start getting people into reading text, almost anyone, regardless of how successful their program is, they'll tell you that there's this bump. There's this real difficult place in teaching Latin where you transfer from the textbook to the real text. I see some nods here. People know about this. Where everything seems like everything that students have learned in their textbook years doesn't seem to translate as smoothly as we would like as they move into reading the real text that we are trying to train them to read. I think there are a number of reasons for this, and I just want to talk about one of them today. So the issue is, I believe, or at least one issue, is the issue of meaning. I believe that students frequently don't really know the real meaning of the words that they think they've learned, and they don't really know the meaning of many of the grammatical constructions that they think they've learned, okay? Even if they've been getting 100% on all the quizzes on that very material, there is a disconnect. And so that's what I want to hone in on today. When people teach meaning, the most common way to do that is to use English equivalents, okay? So, and there's a number of reasons for this, and I think there's some good reasons for this. So if someone wants to know the meaning of a Latin word, I like audience participation. So someone give me a Latin word. Amo. Okay. All right. So if you introduce a Latin word like amo to a class, here's this Latin word, amo. Okay. What is the easiest way to explain what that word means? Okay. I think derivatives are not the easiest way to do it. Okay. The English translation. Okay. So we say amo means I love. Okay. And what happens there is the teacher feels like, oh, okay, I've done due diligence. And the students also feel all secure because you've given them a little bit of English. Okay. English is like a warm blanket and just makes you feel all comfortable. Now I know an English word for that word, and so I can move on. The problem is that with just giving English, even though it's expedient for the teacher and for the student, it doesn't actually teach them what the word means, okay? Or at least all of it. And that kind of imperfect understanding of a word, even as simple as, actually, amo is so not simple. But it seems simple when I explain it, just saying I love. Even something like that can actually cause a lot of trouble. Does anyone know enough about the word amo to know why love is just not a sufficient explanation for this word? It's almost the opposite of Greek, where Greek has all of these specific meanings of love, and you have to make sure you get the right one. Amo is kind of general, but the trouble is that all the early church fathers, when they thought of amare, they were thinking in terms of all the worst possible meanings of that, the sort that Ovid likes to use a lot, okay? And so if you're reading anything from those several centuries written by Christians, there's a good chance that the word amare means something else. Now, we think for Christians, you know, wouldn't you find the word for love all over the Vulgate? You don't find amare. Okay, you're going to find deligere, because the Christian fathers were actually avoiding that word. Okay, but anyway, all that to say, just an English equivalent is not necessarily enough. Okay, but that's what we do. So, I just want to go through a number of the problems with English equivalents. One of them is lexicons. Anyone know when most of the dictionaries for Latin were written? Does anyone know what century they were written in? A little later than that, but the ones that we use today were really written in the 19th century, and occasionally some of them in the 18th century. And this actually poses a serious problem for the way that we come up with English equivalents for these Latin words, because the language that we speak today is not the same as the language that they spoke 200 years ago. The language that they spoke 200 years ago was far closer to Latin than the language that we speak today. And so frequently what happens is the words that you find in these little dictionaries that you think are a really good equivalent for whatever that Latin word is are actually kind of archaic in how they are describing that word. So the other thing is they were written largely in England, the English ones. English Latin dictionaries were written by Englishmen. So there are differences. Even today, if you go to England, you notice that they use all the wrong words. Anyone from England here? Okay. So they use all the wrong words when they're talking about everyday sorts of things. They don't call sprinkles, they call them hundreds and thousands or something weird like that. Okay. I'm not making that up. But when you go back to the English in England of 200 years ago, sometimes these words are very different. So one of the most famous examples is the word frumentum. Okay? If you look in many dictionaries, fermentum, they will give you the word corn. Okay? And of course, what did they mean by corn 200 years ago in England? Okay, they meant wheat. But as Americans, that's confusing. Now, of course, adults aren't going to struggle with that too much. Anyone who's teaching Caesar would know better than that. But but as far as students, they pick up these words. And sometimes, even at the elementary level, where people aren't really focused on reading or the context, and they're just picking up these words, sometimes students are getting stumbled on the meaning of some of these words just because of stuff like that. Here's another example, the word fruitur, or frui in the infinitive. Okay, this is one that, fruor, to use the lexical form there. What is the normal translation for fruor? Anyone know? You didn't know I was going to ask Latin questions. Okay. The normal one you'll see is enjoy. Okay? Now, this word enjoy is not meaning to take pleasure in something like we would think today. The word fruor means to take of the fruit of something. Okay? So in the same, it would be to enjoy the fruits of your labor, kind of enjoy, not I'm enjoying my work. Okay? Anyway, that's the example of the sort of word where almost everyone misunderstands what the word actually means just because of a change in language over time. Another one would be ferol, to bear. Okay? The word bear 200 years ago was very close to our English, or to the Latin word feral. Okay? The trouble is we don't use the word bear very often anymore. And when you're talking with kids, they use it even less often than we do. And so what happens is this word seems a little bit foreign and strange, whereas a word like carry or something like that might be better. Okay, another thing that this English equivalence struggles with is the natural differences between languages. And this is something that people don't really realize until you learn more than one language. If you imagine the whole world, different languages are describing the same world in different ways. I like to think of it as if the world was a puzzle, okay, it would be the same print, but every language has a different cut of all of the jigsaw puzzle pieces are cut differently. So what happens is that different languages will group different things together than other languages. A real clear example of that is with some animals that we think of as all the same. So for instance, Latin does not have a word for owl. Okay? The idea, we, in our minds, we have this idea that there's something called an owl. Okay? And if you really think about it, an owl is any member of a group of species, okay, different species that we know about, and they have kind of a similar look, and some of them hoot and some of them don't. Okay, but we have this idea of owl, and it's actually important to us. Okay, some of our literature, owls play a prominent part in that. Owls matter to us. Okay, to them, they don't have a word for owl. They have a bunch of words for owl. Okay, they've got bubo for an owl with like ears that stick up, and then they've got streaks for the kind that makes a screeching noise, and then they've got a couple others. But they don't have one word for it. And so what happens is if you say, what's the Latin word for owl, it's complicated. Okay, it's difficult to express on a quiz. Going the other way, the word eagle. Okay, this is pretty common in Latin. What is the Latin word for eagle? Okay, aquila. And actually, the word aquila also applies to vultures. Yeah. Okay, it applies to vultures and any raptor. Now, the real aquila would probably be an eagle, but that's just because it's the best aquila. Anyway, so what happens is you can very easily get confused when you just say, oh, aquila means eagle, and that's it. So in is it Matthew 24, where he says, where the rotting meat is, there the eagles will gather. You ever wondered about that? Okay. In both Latin and Greek, that word for eagle can actually mean vulture. It's ambiguous. Okay. It means a lot of things. But anyway, that's another problem there. Sometimes you have words that are just so hard to explain in terms of English, like the word lentus. Lentus means slow or sticky or flexible. Okay. They thought of those things as sort of similar. I have my own theory about this. I think it comes from the word lens, which is the lentil. And if you know, stew lentils, maybe they're slow and sticky and flexible. I don't know. That's probably just made up. But what happens is if you try to explain it in terms of English, it just becomes complicated. And if you choose one of those, okay, then they encounter this word later and it's going to be confusing. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's there is a question of whether or not there's a connection there. Okay. All right, so another issue you have is some words really don't mean anything in English. It's more of, and the only way you can express meaning of them is to show when you use them, not what they mean, okay? So a good example of this is the word quidem. The word quidem, if you look it up in any dictionary, it'll tell you something like, of course, indeed, and that's all it'll give you. What does of course, indeed mean? It means yes? Well, it could. Quidem does not mean that at all. Quidem actually is a word you put after a word you want to emphasize. Okay? So in English, we use the inflection of our voice. And if I want to make one word key to a sentence, you put quidem after it in Latin. In English, you would just raise your voice a little bit. Okay? And in Latin, you'd put quidem after it. So if I wanted to say something like, Mom, I didn't steal the cookie. Okay? We're putting this emphasis on steal, meaning I actually paid for it or something like that, right? In Latin, you put quidem right after it. Okay? Does of course, indeed actually help us understand what that word means? No. And yet that's the way it would be introduced in most textbooks. Another word, nempe, another word, quippe, another word, vero, all used in different places for totally different things. The dictionary will say, of course, indeed, okay, for every one of them. And what happens is students memorize these words, and then they don't really have a clear idea of what they mean as they go through. So these are some of the challenges as you're just using English equivalents to express meaning. And I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the brain. So the brain is made, and memory. The brain is made up of neurons. And when you're actually teaching students and drilling things into their heads, you're actually making physical connections between these little nodes in their brains. So what frequently happens is, even beginning in elementary school, teachers will teach their students to associate one Latin word with one English word, okay? And they might even have them drill it out loud. Puer, boy, puer, boy, puer, boy. And what you're actually doing is you're creating a bridge. Okay, you've got this neuron that's puer, and you've got this neuron that's boy, and you're actually creating this bridge between them. And what happens is the stronger that connection gets, they can't actually see the word puer without saying boy. Okay, they've been conditioned to the point where they say that. Now, puer doesn't always mean boy. Puer can mean child of either gender. It can mean slave if you're being obnoxious, okay? It can do that. Now, it doesn't very often, but what happens is it does maybe 30% of the time. And when a student who's been conditioned to learn one English word runs into it in a real reading, they're reading Cicero or something like that, they use the word puer. He uses the word puer sometimes to mean slave, okay? And then we're all thrown off. We don't know what's going on, Okay, it's all confused. Wait a minute. This is supposed to mean boy, and then you can't figure out what's going on with that sentence. All right. So when you do it like that, it causes problems because there are more options. Okay. What if you were to drill them to know all the options? Okay. So you say, puer means boy, child, slave. Okay. First of all, that would be miserable for your elementary students to memorize that sort of thing. But to have to grade it comes three times as hard. Okay. Yes, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to do that. But what you've done is you've actually created a fork in the road. And so they come to the word puer and they're like, ah, this means boy, this means child, it means slave. What do I do? Now, a good student would look at the whole sentence and determine from the context which one it would need to be. Okay? But what do real students do? Okay? They pick whichever is their favorite, okay? Or the first one, or the one they remember. And then once you've made that choice, it actually colors everything else in the sentence. If you decide, oh, it means slave, okay? Then you actually have no idea what the rest of the sentence means because you've already started off going in the wrong direction. Okay? So having them memorize a branch like this is actually not any better. Okay, this issue also exists in grammar, although it's not as obvious. Winston Churchill wrote a little piece about his Latin education, and I'd really encourage you all to find it and read it. It's delightful because it's Churchill, and he says things. I will summarize. He showed up to boarding school in the bad old days, where he was oriented by being handed a Latin book. And they turned to the first page and said, memorize this. And what he had to memorize said, mensa, table. Mensa, table. Mensam, table. Mensae, of the table. Okay, and so on down through the chart. And the schoolmaster came back after an hour or so and said, do you know it? Do you know what I gave you? And he said, well, because he's just really smart at the age of 10, he goes, well, I think I can say it, sir. Okay. And so he repeated it back to him, and the schoolmaster was very pleased with this. And Winston Churchill says he was emboldened because he was so happy, his instructor was happy, so he decided to ask a question, which was a terrible idea. But he said, well, what does it mean? And the schoolmaster said, well, what do you mean? What is it? It means table, okay? And he said, but what does O table mean? Okay? And the schoolmaster answered, that's what you would say when addressing a table. Okay. And the boy couldn't understand for the life of him what all this was about or why it was important. Okay, that's another example where substituting English equivalents for a real understanding of the way a word is truly used is easy, but it's not necessarily long-term successful. Okay, another good example of this would be the ablative. Okay, one of the ones that we still do today. Ablative means by, with, or from. We like to substitute a handful of prepositions. Okay, that's a great way to get through your quiz and through your textbook Latin, but you will never be able to read Virgil if you think that ablative means by, with, or from. Okay, and you will never be able to make sense of Virgil if you think that the dative means to and for, and that's it. Okay, giving those English equivalents gets you through 60% of it, okay? But if you only understand 60% of it, you're not going to actually be able to be successful there. Okay, another one is the subjunctive, would, could, should, okay? I actually ran into a professor teaching a PhD-level class in Latin where she said, this is a would, could. Or a would should, I can never remember. Okay, a would should construction. And I had translated it, if I were to do this, I would do that. which is the normal American way to do it. And she stumbled because she wasn't sure if they were the same thing and had to struggle through this for a little bit. The problem was she had substituted a little formula for actually understanding what it meant. Okay. Now, anyway, this is the problem. So I want to... Right.
I was like, am I commanding God to do this in this prayer, or am I asking him? So it's like, it felt like really prideful on the floor praying that to use it indirectly like there's something. And then another gentleman explained to me that, well, that's a subjunctive, so we use that.
That's right. This is not theoretical. We're not talking about getting to really difficult Latin passages that you can't get. You will run into this right away in the first paragraph that you get to when you start reading real Latin. Okay, Jerome, the Vulgate, some of the easiest Latin there is, he does not follow the rules that your textbook has set out for him. Okay, he disobeys a lot. Okay, in the notes, I put something about the Germans. It was a long time ago, and I have lots of bad things to say about German grammarians, but I can't remember what it had to do with this talk, so I'm going to skip it. Just say bad things about Germans. Okay, so I like Germans, but... The grammarians from the 19th century. Well, I think their problem is they tend to try to explain all of Latin in terms of German, which just makes it more complicated. And the Germans are really smart, so they can handle it, but no one else ends up knowing Latin. Anyway, so I want to make this a practical talk. So I've given you the problem. So what can you do about it? Now, I want to, again, get a little bit out of my outline here. I put composition as the last item there. I'm going to talk about it first. The easiest way to deal with this is simply to reverse how you teach vocabulary and grammar. Instead of teaching, here's some Latin, here's what it means in English, actually switch it and say, here's some English, how would you say that in Latin? And that actually will solve 70% of your problems in having your students understand meaning. Okay? Why? Why does that simple switch change everything? Anyone have any idea? And they understand what you're talking about in English, which means that you can have a nice little conversation about what it is you're really talking about before you give them a Latin word. So they have a real clear concept. Okay? So let's do that a little bit just to illustrate. Okay? I want some examples of English words, and I'd appreciate it if they existed 2,000 years ago. So I don't have to see if I know a made-up Neo-Latin word for it. What's that?
Boat.
Boat. Okay. Now, boat in English can be multiple things. What could it be? Okay. It could be the noun, it could be a vehicle for traveling over water with. Okay, what else could it be? Okay, well, it could be a particular kind, but it could also be a verb. Okay, you can boat. And I don't know, are there any other meanings of boat? That one's pretty safe. But, what's that? Oh, boat shoes? Yeah, okay, there's that too. So anyway, you could say the verb to boat would be navigare. And the noun would be navis. But when we use the word boat, we normally are talking about a smaller boat. So navicula would be better, or scafa, okay, if you're really talking about a rowboat, which is probably what you're going to be talking about. So we talked about it in English, figured out exactly what we meant, and then we picked out the right word. The audience has no questions about what this means. Okay, this is something you can apply at any level. In fact, I find with younger kids, they'll have a conversation. They love having a group conversation about the actual stuff you're talking about, okay? So if you have a short 10-second, oh, not 10, it's with third graders, so it's going to be much longer than that, okay? Have a 5-minute discussion with third graders on what a boat is, and you listen to all their stories about their experiences with boats, okay? And then you teach them the word novice, they're going to remember it better, and they're going to know exactly what you're talking about. Boat is not a hard one, though. There's a low risk. Let's have some other words. Teacher. Okay, teacher is a good one because, okay, everyone understands what a teacher is in this context. What's the Latin word for teacher? Magister. Do you guys know what else magister can mean? Okay. It can mean it's like a taskmaster, not like a, you don't use it when you're if you're a slave talking to your master. Okay. And that's a great example where master confuses us because we think master means, talking to the owner of the house. But magister is never used that way. At least I've never seen it used that way. It's talking about the guy at the back of the ship cracking the whip, or the guy at the back of the line of soldiers who's poking everybody, telling them to move on. That's what the magister is, which makes a lot of sense. You know, you understand why they use the same word. Okay, we poke students to move on, and yeah. Anyway, the point is though, it's very easy just to invert it. Because you can have this conversation in English and talk about what it is and then give them the right Latin word. If I believe that we would remove half of our problems if we just took the time to go through our vocab at whatever level and do that. Yeah, I think that would solve it, especially if you went through and the first time you explained what you meant by all of those words, or they had some logical connection to each other, so it was obvious. Okay, one of the best ways to do this is with examples. Okay, now this is going to look different depending on what level you're teaching at. If you're in elementary school, you're not probably going to give them a Latin example that they're going to benefit from. Okay. However, you can just use the Latin word in the middle of an English sentence. It's easy. So you just say, this morning my magister wrote my name on the board. Okay? Just by giving an example like that, you make it clear. Or even better, make the students come up with the examples. Okay? And if you figured out this wonderful thing with the little whiteboards where everyone has their own particular whiteboard and you say, hey, everybody, give me an example of the word magister, write an English sentence and use it in there. Okay, they all write it. It gives you a great opportunity to kind of scan across, see if everyone can do it, keep them all engaged. And then when someone gets it wrong, take it and point it out and everyone has a good laugh, not at them, but depends. Okay, on your mood. Anyway, examples are great. At a high school level, you can just use them in Latin sentences, require students to use them in Latin sentences, again, on whiteboards or something like that. Images. I'm a really big fan of illustrations. Illustrations are very hard to produce if you don't have skills. Depending on if you have the skills to do that, that's fine. If you get a chance and you're interested, at our booth, Pictodicta is an entire vocabulary built around illustrations and explanations and things like that. So you can see an example of kind of what that can look like. But you can incorporate that sort of thing into your class classes if you have the ability to do that or figure out how to bring those in. Definitions and explanations. Definitions can be really, really helpful. Not just on their own, but you really just take some time to talk about the words. Take some time to talk about what these words mean before you have them memorize them and put them on a quiz, and it can make a huge difference. Translations work well too, but when they're in context. Okay, so it is very difficult to produce a real translation unless you actually have some context to work with. And so that is a really good way to do it. I think it's not rocket science how to do that, really. It's just some common sense measures to make sure that people really understand what you're talking about. But I think oftentimes we're in such a hurry to get people to memorize something that we don't make sure that they're memorizing something that will actually be useful down the line. So I hope that is practical for you. That's all I wanted to say. I think we have a couple minutes for questions, so if you guys would like to ask some, I'd be happy to answer.
I think for an extra,
the natural world is 350 words, 380 words from nature. Yeah, that's for the elementary program. And I think you will find that 380 words from nature is more words than the kids actually know from nature in many cases. There's a ton of stuff in there. So there's a lot there. In the other one, Vocabulary Builder, there's 1,000 words that are commonly used. Yes? Yeah, so prepositions, I teach one meaning at a time, and I probably should have said that. So, and this is true of any word that has a lot of meanings. Latin has about 30,000 words in it. You don't need to know 30,000 in order to read well, but 30,000. English has hundreds of thousands of words. And so what generally happens is one Latin word will correspond to many, many English words. What happens is, if you feel this burden to try to explain all of the Latin word or the English meanings of a Latin word all at once, you won't be able to do it. Okay, so it's a much better idea just to pick one at a time. So something like a preposition, start with its most basic physical meaning. And with something like Greek, you've got a particular case that's connected with that. You can teach them how to use that, and then you move on to the next one. It's very effective. Okay, good. Any other questions? Yes. Absolutely. So with the dative, I always teach grammar this way, where I will present a situation where they need something like an indirect object. And we will just talk in English about the idea of indirect object and what it is for a good 10 minutes. Okay, we just spend some time working through this concept. And then once they start to get it, I'll say, okay, this is how you do it in English. Sorry, this is how you do it in Latin. Okay, and we will move on and then do some examples, and then they'll do some composition work on their boards as they try to use it to say intelligible things. And they do understand it that way. And it's really just taking time out of your class to make them understand why it's important, how it works, before you start teaching the Latin. Yes? Yeah, that's a fantastic way to do it, and it'll work for some kinds of learners. Some people are really example-oriented. Others will struggle with that. But a great example of that is the word ecce. Okay, everybody thinks they know ecce. Okay, what does ecce mean? Okay, behold is the common translation. It's better to talk about what it does instead of the word, because we don't use the word. Well, at least most of us don't use the word behold very often. Okay, ecce is a word that is used to direct someone else's attention to something. Okay, it can be something you see. It could also be something you hear. So if someone is calling you, you could say ecce. Okay, and a good translation of that would actually be what? Look. If it would be listen. Okay, it wouldn't be look. Because somebody's calling you, right? If you can't see them, hey, do you hear that? Okay, that actually would have the same effect. So sometimes just showing the situation where you would use it can really help them understand it better. Right. Yep. Ecce was actually my daughter's first word. But think about it. It never occurred to me before that happened. That makes a lot of sense. That's so, I mean, if you're a Latin teacher. So there you go. Well, thank you very much. I'd be happy to talk to you guys afterwards, and if you have any more questions, I'll also be at the Pictodicta NSA Latin booth. It is classical, but I have to confess that I don't use a W sound. I use the bilabial fricative, which means it sounds, instead of wainy, weedy, weaky, which I think would have gotten Caesar killed several years earlier, okay, I like to say veiny, beedy, beaky. Veiny, beedy, beaky, not veiny, beedy, beaky. It's, anyway, that's the only difference. It's a little Spanish. I'm not a pronunciation snob, although I do like to make fun of W's. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Oh, good. Yeah. Yes. I should have said this to everyone, but one of the best books out there is written by a guy named Paul Dissler called Teach the Latin, I Pray You, and it is just chocked full of really practical exercises for classrooms. It's written in the 70s by this Roman Catholic priest, and he's a genius.
Teach the Latin, I Pray You.
I Pray You.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, he was somebody who talked like that. Gotcha. So, Paul Dissler.
Yeah. That's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that.
I just wanted to introduce you. I'm in your class. I'm Sarah
Collins. Oh, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
in
you.
Person.
In person, yes.
Okay.
And I wanted to say I love the method. It's really helpful. I'm not from London. I'm an English teacher, but I'm not from London. My strength is grammar. And so
yes.
I actually feel that it's very intuitive.
Oh, good. Good. Well, it's amazing how much examples help. And the whole idea is I kind of... Here's how it works, and here's so many examples that
right.
If your eyes glossed over in the first part, yes. Then hopefully you get it. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So, hi.
How do you spell amo? A-M-O?
Yes.
It means in Spanish, I love.
Yes, right. Oh, yeah. And I found Spanish seems to me to be closer to Latin even than Italian, at least. Yes. That's right. It is. Amar. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I do. So, in fact, I use it. And my products that I've built have really been, I deliberately built them to be compatible with it. Lingua Latina is the best reader that exists, but it has no grammatical explanation.
Someone did create.
That's true. Yes, I know her. She, it's a college companion. I don't think that it's very pedagogical for younger students. It would definitely work for higher, for older students. So,
without it at the beginning,
it's very difficult.
We're going from learning Latin or whatever to the primers.
Yeah.
And we went to that bump was crazy hard.
Yes.
Like, for me and for them, and so once we got the companion, we're like, and because it fills with the meaning.
That's right. Yeah, that would definitely be good. My NSA Latin is an introduction through the Vulgate, but it uses a very similar progression to Lingua Latina. And the way I use it is, I teach them all the grammar and examples through the Vulgate, and then let them read Lingua Latina. And Vocabulary Builder has about 90% of Lingua Latina's vocabulary in it, and so it's very easy to, you essentially learn through the pictures, and then you're seeing them in context, and that's the combination that has worked extremely well for me.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I very much like that.
2 days a week with them, and then they have another two by themselves. So we basically read the grammar, or make them read the companion on their own, and we work through it together.
Yeah.
Forever at the beginning, like for the first semester, it was the equivalence thing.
Yes.
It was killing me, it was killing them. And when they just, I said, just read it and stop trying to, fit it onto the scale and make it work.
Right.
They started to relax that way, and they, this actually flows better and easier than it was before.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's part of, because we grammarized them by memorizing it, in the Latin, English, Latin, English, Latin.
Right, yeah. It is interesting how if you have a very severe case, it can actually be harder to teach them Latin than it would have been if they hadn't had Latin. It doesn't, it's not always the case. But if you have a student, particularly with slow students that have had too much of that, they tend, sometimes they just can't get out of it. Like they can never, yeah, they can't. Yes. Yes.
And you're telling me there's two more?
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, I am.
Yeah.
Welcome to Lord.
Well,
that's what I see. They're still, you know, they're reading a story about a captain of a boat, and they're translating MacGyver as a teacher.
Right.
Think about this.
So you've been there. You knew exactly what I was talking about.
They fixed that earlier where the teacher beating the
yes.
The magister is beating his students, so they figure out, oh, this is not just normal.
Yeah,
teaching.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good image.
Yeah.
No, and how much we can kind of put that into, if we make up translations, we can kind of like sneak in the connotations right there.
Yep. That's very important.
A little bit of the lingua latina has helped me with the younger kids and like try to explain things better to them. Say, okay, now it doesn't mean just black and white. It's a lot more to it.
So. Yeah.
And we use Dr. Kern's Latin for Children.
Okay.
And I think next semester, I'm going to start Latin Live with the kids who have finished Latin C. So, you know, we're right at that brink of there's more uses of dative and there's more uses of adjective. No, adjective doesn't mean near. That's the preposition, you know. And
yeah.
By means of, and that kind of stuff. We're just kind of crossing that brink.
Yeah.
They're thinking, like, oh, I thought I learned it.
I know.
And that's a problem because then they feel like, checked it off my list. And now you're telling me.
Right. If you invert, what happens is they're never surprised when there are more meanings. So if I tell you, if I say, how do you say teacher? Magister. And then 3 years later, they say, how do I say ship captain? And you say magister. Instead of going, what? They'll say, oh, that's funny. But because you never presented it, yeah, it is. You've presented it as, oh, okay. There's a fun connection there. That's interesting that they do that. It's not, but you lied to me. it's this word.
And it's kind of like going from one of those laws of teaching, right? You're going from the known into the unknown when you start with what they know.
Yes.
But the other way, you're starting from the unknown and then connecting it to what they know.
That's a good point.
And you've got this like you don't know everything yet. So then you're still...
Right. And we're also assuming that... We know the English words, and I think the problem is we're just being naive about English, as if English is that simple.
Yeah,
And I think from a text point, you know, having written a textbook, it's really hard to actually make things concise and effective, and the temptation is just, oh, I'll just throw in an English word in there because that solves my problem. But it creates problems. NSA Latin, it's kind of a flipped classroom model thing, so it's all videos on how to use the Latin Bible, or how to, it basically teaches Latin through illustrations, and then you do readings in the Latin Bible. Yes, the Pictodicta NSA Latin booth.
What was that word you used? Because when you got through the Brevis chant, right? Like, we cannot use that word sound. And so, you know.
Brevia.
Oh my gosh, you sound like you've got a bunch of speech in front of
Brevium, yeah. It's called the bilabial fricative. And all you, so the way you do it, I think the issue is this. The W, we make a U sound by putting our lips way out from our face. But what happens is if you turn that into a consonant, it has this draw. So you go wany, wany. And it's this real, the slide. But I, because of the spelling mistakes that the Romans are actually making, they're actually making spelling mistakes between U, V, and B, which means that they were keeping their embouchure tighter, and they were actually not saying ooh, they were saying ooh. And when you make that into a consonant, it becomes veiny, V, you touch your lips, va, va, va. It's not this, and it's not this, but it's va. So you have kind of a smiling face, and then you go va, veiny, vidi, viki. Sounds like a V, a B, or a W, somewhere in between there, which is exactly what they did. So it's just much tighter. And I think that sloppy German W has probably never happened. Well, there is something that's like that, but I'm talking about the W sound. The W sound, I think they reasoned that they must have been making a W sound because in Latin, the U is actually the same letter as the V. And so they were saying, oh, how would that be a consonant? Ooh, wah. But that was just an argument that somebody came up with in the 1800s. So a lot of people will use a very subtle W sound, which is probably very close, or what I'm doing, which is a bilabial thing. But anyway, I'm not a snob about it at all. I just say, look, if you want people to use it, you can't sound like a fool. And I don't really care if people want to use ecclesiastical, that's fine. If they want to use classical, that's fine. But they just won't use it if they sound stupid. And so
it's all the power out of that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, they would have killed him earlier.